Okay, we are just at the 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. As usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. If you do so, to ask a question or make a comment, please remute yourself afterwards to keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, courtesy of Alan, the contents of the deck we're going through tonight, as well as the audio track and the contents of the chat window, will go up on our website. So welcome all, welcome guests. If we have any guests who are new with us tonight, we welcome guests at any time. The Ottawa PC is a group meeting. You can come as often as you want as a guest. However, if you do want to join, I paste it into the chat where you can go to join up, or you can just go to our homepage and click on the Join or Renew button at the top, and that'll take you through the process, and it's just $20 a year. And with that, we have a bunch of stuff on the agenda, so I will hand it off to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, and we're going to start with a couple of items that were in the chat last week. The first one was about downloading videos, and Marvo said he was using safefrom.net, but they recently changed their policies, and you now, if you're in Canada, you're not allowed to use this particular system. So he was asking, what other sites do people recommend? And Jose said there are three different things, two which he uses regularly, RealPlay Downloader and Video Downloader Helper, which is an extension to the Firefox web browser. And he points out that the ones that work on various videos are diverse. Sometimes both work, sometimes only one works, and sometimes for certain videos, neither of them will allow him to download a video. But at least the two options are there, I guess, most of the time. And Jose points out that he wasn't aware of this safefrom.net, but he tried it out as a third alternative, and it does work if he activates a VPN. So if you're interested in downloading videos, there are some options to do so. And the second one was a posting from Richard Bradford in Melbourne, Australia, about a system called Atlas OS, which is essentially a stripped-down version of Windows 11. And basically, the developers have taken out all of the telemetry and bloatware and all of that kind of stuff, and produced a non-reporting, I guess, version of Windows. Now, to use this, you do actually need a Windows 11 license, so it's not a free version of Windows. You have to have a legitimate copy of Windows. But it is being updated right now, and the current version is from last October. Richard also provided this YouTube video about the developers having built a, quote, better Windows than Microsoft. I point out, if you're a Microsoft fan, you're not going to like this video, because it's essentially a diatribe against Microsoft's privacy issues, their telemetry reporting everything that you do, and sending updates whether you want them or not, and stealing or off, no, and accessing all of your data and doing all kinds of wonderful things, selling it to other people for various uses. And clearly, whoever developed the video is not a fan of Redmond. So bear that in mind if you decide to watch it. Okay, so those are the two I had, and Chris has got a couple of things here. One is a YouTube video.
Yeah, okay. So, I've subscribed to the Intelligence, and I get it by email frequently. I think it's a couple of times a week or something. I get one or another from them. I find often they have some very interesting tools that they talk about. And this one might be preaching to the choir here, but it was a list of five tools that will make you harder to hack. And so anybody who is concerned about security, and especially if you think you don't really have a robust security posture, you might want to take a look at this particular article. And you can see the titles of the five items that they think will make it harder to hack your system. And so if you are concerned about that, by all means, good idea to check them out. And I'll let everybody guess which four I use on a regular basis. There is one that I don't use, and I think for a good reason. And which ones do you use? So I'm curious if there are people who are using all of those tools, or if you're not using some of the tools, why you think that those are not worthy of your usage. No, Tom, we don't have a vote to vote on. That would have been an idea, actually. I hadn't thought about that.
Well, I can tell you that I use one and two. I don't use anything special for five other than whatever's built into the operating system. And my guess is you don't use four.
That's right. Breach checkers, I think you use that as well, Alan. That's primarily what they're talking about is, have I been pwned?
No, I don't use that.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Anyhow, something that I think, you know, a lot of people should take a look at this list and seriously consider whether any or all of them can be useful to you to help protect your computer and your privacy. That's it.
Well, Tommy's on your page. He doesn't use number four either.
Yeah.
And Tom has just put the Have I Been Pwned link in the website.
Yeah.
In the chat, the URL in the chat window.
And Tim thought I didn't use three, but I do actually use Have I Been Pwned, but I don't use data removal services. The primary reason why I don't use data removal services is I don't know of any of them that are free, and most of them cost a lot. Like, you're talking over $10 US a month for these data removal services, and I'm unconvinced that they really do all that good, but that's a bit of a guess on my part. But
isn't
because
outrageous?
I'm a cheap SLB, I don't pay for them.
That's interesting, Chris. What data do they remove?
Well, they purport to go in to all these sources on the Internet who may have information about you and request removal of the data.
It's mainly American sources that they work. There is, I'll put a link in the chat. There is one where you can go in yourself and see what's there out there for a variety, something like the several hundred different data brokers. You can do it all by yourself, but of course it's a continuing job. California has a law now and a service for free for all California residents that will get them removed from all the data brokers and keep them removed for free.
Yeah. Supposedly. I'm a skeptic. Anyhow, that's it for that. Check it out.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. So next up, I have an app suggested by Jeff Dubois. I notice Jeff isn't here tonight. Yeah, I know he's busy. Those of you who know Jeff, you know that he has a vision impairment, and he's big on adaptive tools, notably screen readers and magnification type systems. And he's pointing out this application that's available for either Android or the iPhone called Seeing AI. And he says that although it's designed for people who are vision impaired like him and totally blind, as most of us age, we have trouble seeing smaller print. And then I realize he's talking about me. And he says its features are too numerous to mention, and giving a demonstration over Zoom isn't feasible. It's very much a kind of a hands-on, you download it, try it, and if it's not useful, you can just delete it. It's a free tool, so it's just a question of time and effort to download and try it. Now, Jeff says basically when he's not at home and has access to his regular desktop tools, then this app uses the phone's camera and speakers. So he points the camera at some text, and it will read the text back to him. So I tried it out. So I gave it this this label, which has a couple of problems. It's fairly tiny print, and the contrast isn't huge between the black and the kind of brown. And so basically, I open my phone, and this is the window you see. You can see that there, by default, it comes up in the read option on the bottom of the screen there. And then there's a describe button, which we'll talk about in a second. And then all the other multiple features that Jeff was talking about are under that more menu item. So basically, you open up the app, and as soon as it sees the image, it starts reading the text back to you. So it's, obviously, it's using OCR and then doing a text-to-speech conversion, and it will read the text that it sees in the image. You notice that little icon that's sliced out there on the left-hand side with the yellow circle around it. If you actually click on that, then it basically now takes the text that it's viewing and drops it into a larger version that you can actually view. So for people like me, when you've got tiny little print in low light conditions and low contrast source, and pointing the thing and having it give me a nice black on white in fairly big font, I can actually read the fine print, as they say, on things. And it seems to do a really good job. The OCR seems pretty accurate as far as I didn't check it out word for word, but it looks good. The describe one is interesting. If you do the same thing, if you, instead of using the read, you hit on that describe button, you notice that it says it shows the back of a Western Digital product box placed on a keyboard. So it's actually, it really is describing what it sees in the image. And then it's giving me the printed text there, but it's not really giving me the text. Again, it's describing it. It says the text mentions trademarks and product specifications related to Western Digital, yada, yada, yada. So it's really kind of a neat little tool. I'm sure it has applications for some. And the URL is in that first slide. And try it out and see if you like it.
That should come as a pamphlet inside your pill bottle, because you get the antibiotic to kill the virus, but you can't read the pill bottle because you got to get a magnifying glass to read it.
That's exactly right. And that's basically what this thing is. It's quite a neat little tool. Anyway, there we go. Worth a look if you have that problem. Okay, next up, Chris.
Yeah, in the ongoing keyboard shortcut series. So we're up to number 10. And again, this is the idea that you want to keep your hands on the keyboard as much as possible and not have to reach over to the mouse and start moving it around and clicking on things if a keyboard shortcut can do it for you faster and easier. So if you're in Windows File Explorer and you want to rename a file, so if you do it through mouse actions or things like that, you can select the file by clicking on it, and then you can click on rename on the toolbar. Or if you want to do it even worse, you can right-click on the file, and then you choose Show More Options, Rename. And it was under recent versions of File Explorer that they actually moved the rename option under More Options, so it's even more clicks. So rather than doing that, all you have to do is hit F2, and F2 will highlight the file name, and it excludes the file extension, which I think is kind of clever, because usually when you rename a file, you're not looking to rename the file extension. You're just looking to rename the name portion of it. So it just highlights that, so you can immediately just start typing it, and it will replace the current file name with whatever you type. So you type it in, press Enter, or you can actually use the arrow keys to move over and rename the file extension as well if you want. And if you're in the middle of it and you make a mistake, you can just hit Control-Z, and that will undo the name change immediately. So that's your keyboard shortcut number 10.
And the next item is yours too, Chris.
Yes. Okay. The next one, and let me just paste into the chat on here. So this is a YouTube video. And it's disposable windows for maximum security. We had some questions about doing about virtual machines. And so this is one that is specifically about the Windows virtual machine that is built into Windows itself. So with that, it's using Windows Sandbox. Unfortunately, Sandbox is only available in Windows Pro, Enterprise, and Education, so it's not available in the Home Edition, but if you do happen to have Pro, Enterprise, or Education, you can take advantage of it. So the thing that is used in here with Dave Plummer, he uses it for a testing environment. So the good thing about the Windows Sandbox is that it just does not affect anything that goes on in that at all will not affect your normal Windows configuration. So if you have a suspicious app or an app that you figure is going to clutter itself onto your computer and things like that, you can do it in the Windows Sandbox. And when you close the sandbox, everything in the sandbox disappears. Now, that can be a shortcoming as well. So if you actually need persistence where you can shut down the virtual machine, the sandbox, and then when you start it up again, have access to everything that was in that sandbox, you don't get that with sandbox. It is absolutely just destroys everything. When you start up sandbox, it's brand new and fresh. If you actually do need that persistence, then you have to use the full virtual machine, such as VirtualBox.
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
I discovered that with the Windows Sandbox, there's actually layers to it. Most of the sandbox is in an encapsulated form, but it turns out that there are other things like Microsoft Edge, the viewer, Edge Chromium, is actually layered into it. So if you uninstall Edge Chromium and then start up the sandbox, you won't have Edge in there anymore. Also, if you change anything in your Edge browser, that change will then be in your sandbox version as well.
That's interesting. I did not know that. I thought it always came back with a pristine...
That's what I thought too, but it doesn't. It actually layers it.
Very interesting. Cool.
Because what I wanted to do was to start the sandbox without Edge and have it with Firefox. But it won't let you do that.
Well, it definitely won't let you put Firefox in it and have that come up each time.
Well, you can do it, but it's more effort than it's worth.
Okay. And, yes, Andrew says, if you need a virtual environment in Windows Pro, Hyper-V is accessible, and Hyper-V will also give you that persistence if you want it. So, yeah, most virtual machines do give you that persistence. Windows Sandbox is the only one I know of that it is designed specifically to just make everything disappear, and you start off fresh each time, with, I guess, the exception of any changes to Edge.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. So moving along, I have a 2x2 item for you. A number of years ago, I got really tired of Adobe Acrobat updating itself twice every day almost, it seemed. And then Chris pointed out at some stage that Adobe has a huge market share, but is a huge target for hackers and is prone to vulnerabilities, which I guess is why I got so many updates. Anyway, I took Chris's advice and switched to a much less well-known PDF viewer, and I was using my recent one is PDF Exchange Viewer, which is the item on the left here. Essentially, it isn't actually. It's the older version that was available, and now it's actually being updated. But recently, I came across Ocular as a Windows app, and I'll talk about both of these as alternatives to Adobe Acrobat. And good alternative too. Now, that being said, my requirements are pretty simple. All I really do is read PDF files, and I mainly use it in full page mode while paging through a document, and then fit width type views so that I get larger text to actually read. I have to have page navigation, so I need buttons that will go through the document, both forwards and backwards, as controls. Occasionally, I want to be able to cut and paste text from a PDF file into a document. And more recently, I've also started using yellow highlighting in certain documents to indicate that I've dealt with various items in that document. And so I have been using PDF Exchange Viewer, but that has recently been deprecated and, well, essentially replaced by the same company's version of an editor. So PDF Exchange Editor is now the software of choice if you want to download it from the developer. Ocula, I've been using on my Linux box for quite a while. I use Linux Mint. It's actually a KDE tool, which is a different desktop environment. but it works well on Debian systems, Mint, for example. It's much simpler. It doesn't have as many tools, especially the editor. But it is cross-platform, so I can use now. I know there's a Windows version. I can use the same program essentially in both Linux and Windows, and they're both free. The editor, they will try and sell you the pro version, but there is a free version if you look carefully at the website. And of course, Ocula is open source, so it's a totally free, free from cost and free from kind of privacy type issues too. So this is PDF Exchange Editor. Editor Plus is the paid version, and Exchange Editor itself is the free version. And it works really well. And here's the newsletter open in the PDF Exchange Editor. I quite like the thumbnails down the left hand side, so you can see the individual pages fairly quickly. They're actually easy to turn off if you wish. And you can see it here in the page width view, so I'm looking at fairly easily readable text there. But bear in mind, this is an editor. So when you look on the top ribbon there, it's got dozens of menu entries, it's got dozens of icons and tools and all kinds of things that you can do. And this is way too much for my particular purposes. As I said, what I really want to do is I want to be able to select text. This is the button down here. Here are the buttons to go forwards and backwards through the document. The yellow highlighter tool is over here on the ribbon. I can set the page views in. These are actually quite nice. You can go full page view or page width view using these icons, or you can zoom to all kinds of percentages here. Another nice thing is if you open multiple files, multiple PDF files, then you can open them as individual tabs, and then you can easily switch between them just by clicking on the appropriate tab. And if you want to do all kinds of other things like converting it and taking snapshots of things, then there are all kinds of other tools available to you in this free PDF Exchange Editor. But as I said, I actually now like this program called Ocula, which is essentially a PDF viewer. Basically, it looks very similar. It's got thumbnails again down the side. I can choose full or page width. And I've got various tools in the ribbon, but not as many as I had in the PDF Exchange Editor. But it's got everything I want. I can change the way that the page is being displayed. I can go forwards and backwards using these down and up arrows here through the document. I can select text. I can highlight paragraphs. And again, I've got multiple tabs if I want to open them that way. And I forget whether I've got an example of that or not. I don't think I do. By default, it doesn't use multiple tabs. It will open multiple files in multiple windows, which actually is really nice. I quite like that. But there's a setting, and I think I've got the setting somewhere, where you can switch it so it goes to tabs. One of the really neat things, Jeff Dubois would like this, is that if you go to the tools, you've got all kinds of different tools here. One of them is actually to have it read the document to you. So if you go into the settings and find a speech synthesizer that will work with your version of Windows, then once you click on Speak the Current Page, then the thing just starts reading the page to you, which is really quite nice. And I think that's actually a good option if you're writing Word documents like newsletter articles for our club's newsletter, then you could have it read it back to you, and that's actually a good way of doing proofreading. And here's the option where by default it opens in multiple windows, but if you check this box right here, then you can open these multiple files in different tabs. So those are the programs which I actually like to use. So my question for you now is, what PDF readers are you using? What are the main features? And do you recommend it for use by other people?
We had a couple of questions. Timothy asked, can the free PDF editor version add or remove pages? And in actual fact, Harvey answered saying, yes, it can.
Good, because I didn't know.
Delete, insert, and reorder pages. And we also had a question, and I can't find it. It seems to have disappeared. There was a question about whether the free PDF Exchange editor can read a document to you. Do you know if we can do that? I know you said Ocular can.
No, yeah, Ocular can. I don't know about the other one. I've not tried.
Okay.
I don't think it does, but who knows? It's free, so download it and try it.
Yeah. And Tom asked if Ocular supports editing.
Can Ocular be used on Windows?
Yes, it's cross-platform.
Ah, excellent.
Can it be used for editing? I don't think so. It's just a viewer.
Just a viewer, yeah. Okay.
Well, it's just a viewer with annotation options, like yellow highlighting, for example, but I don't think you can change the text.
Karen,
yeah, it's free. Try it.
Yeah, I think Karen asked, can you review what edit features and security add passwords it has? I guess try it out and see.
Or ask an AI chatbot. It will tell you.
Yeah, that's right.
May or may not be right.
Right. Jose says, do any of these support OCR for scanned PDF files?
And I'm sure Ocular doesn't. I don't know about the editor, okay. PDF Exchange editor.
Yeah, I would strongly suspect it just treats it as a graphic.
I strongly suspect if it does that, it's the pro version.
Hey, that's true. Yeah, they gotta reserve something for to get your money. Okay, and Tom says he used Sumatra.
Yes, Sumatra is another free PDF viewer, which is probably much more secure than Adobe Acrobat.
And Carol uses PDF Gear. I used to use PDF Gear because it was, at the time, the only free one that actually added editing capabilities. But I found that editing a PDF file usually is really, really problematic, other than the most simple of changes. The structure within it, what you see is way, way surfaced from the underlying structure of it all. And when you get into editing, it's that underlying structure that you end up having to deal with. And I found it to be really, really bad. So I sort of gave up on PDF Gear, although as a viewer, it seemed to be pretty fine too.
PDFs are all text files except for the pictures. So you can just edit the text yourself and see what fancy formatting screwed up you have.
Yeah, I'm sure that you'd have a lot of screw-ups for sure. Anybody who is still using Adobe Reader, I beg you, get off of it. It is the Typhoid Mary of the Internet, and they come up with multiple updates every year that fix multiple things, any one of which could allow an attacker to take over your computer completely. Get it off your computer and get on any of the free PDF viewers.
And if you want to try editing PDF files, if you use LibreOffice, then LibreOffice Draw will open a PDF file and allow you to edit it. But as Chris said, it cannot be, it's not always pretty.
Yeah, it can be pretty, pretty ugly. Okay, I think that was all.
Well, Serge Elix says PDF Exchange Editor can also read text.
Oh, neat. Yeah, that could be nice to sit back and let it read it to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I discovered that LibreOffice can even view EPS files, which is something most Windows programs can't do.
Okay, thank you very much. Next up is another item from Chris.
Yeah, ad-free YouTube. And this is something that I run into quite regularly. I go to watch a YouTube video, and it comes up and says, ad blockers violate the terms of service, and I can't watch it because I'm using some kind of ad blocker. I'm actually using multiple ad blockers, and it annoys me to no end that I just have to turn them off in order to watch a YouTube video. And I was taking to just using another lesser-used web browser that didn't have an ad blocker, and anytime I wanted to watch a YouTube video, I just watched it in that. But I came across this, which was actually kind of cool. So if you run into this, and the URL that's on there would be an example of one of them that popped up and told me this. But I came across this in, again, the intelligence. So this is one of the cool tools that they tell you about. And so if you go in and you just add a dash between the T and the U in tube, and you hit enter, all of a sudden, oh, you can watch it. No problem, and you're not nagged. And this is in the same browser that I was using that gave me the blocking. Now, what I found was it interesting is what it actually redirected you to. And you can see on the screen there, it redirects to youtube-nocookie.com/embed, and then the YouTube video name itself or the code for that particular YouTube, and then playlist and autoplay and all this stuff is added in. But you get to watch it without any ads, which I thought was pretty cool. So then I thought, well, who actually owns up-ube.com? And so I went and I checked it out with Perplexity. I asked it, who owns that? And it turns out that that's owned by Squarespace Domains, and goes way, way back to 2017 and was specifically set up to allow people to actually watch YouTube videos without ads. And it ends up saying it appears to be unrelated to Alphabet, who owns Google, who owns YouTube, or YouTube itself. Now, before I go off of this screen, you'll see that the domain is set to expire May 6th, 2026. This was as of about a week ago. So I'm not sure if they're renewing this or not. This may be not working as of tomorrow. I have no clue. I'm going to check it out. But hopefully they're going to continue on with it. So then, who owns, it redirected to youtube-nocookie.com. And so I said, well, who owns that? And it turns out that that's actually owned by Google. And so the domain that you end up getting redirected to is actually a Google service and is apparently associated with their privacy enhanced embed feature. And the Whois record points to Google LLC as the owner of that particular domain. So the long and short of it is the hack is by Squarespace Domains. It restructures your YouTube URLs to use a Google owned service to illuminate the ads on YouTube videos. And apparently it's been around for quite a while, and YouTube has not seen fit to do away with it. So if you have a problem getting pop-ups saying that you have an ad blocker and not allowed to watch this YouTube video, just add that dash in between the T and the U, and at least as of today, you'll be able to watch it.
There was another one where you added PP at the end of YouTube.
Okay.
For a few years, hasn't for a while now, though.
Oh, okay.
Just a note, as you can see, there are basically you have the URL with the last ID for the YouTube video, and then you have a series of parameters, playlist equals, autoplay, etc. Those parameters can be in any order. They start with an ampersand. If it's the second or later parameter, And the first one starts with a question mark, like question mark playlist is the first parameter. So if you do any editing of existing YouTube references that you want to give out to people, it's probably you can just replace the stuff in the middle and put the playlist, for example, at the end. And then you will have you'll be able to redirect people to YouTube videos without any ads.
And it turns out that all of those parameters are required, I believe. I tried playing around with a little bit, taking out the autoplay, taking out the IV underscore load underscore policy equals 3 and things like that. And it seemed like everything that I tried doing broke it so that it didn't work anymore. So it really seems to need all of those parameters. So if you are playing around with it, you're probably going to need them all.
So Karen's asking if it removes all of the ads, the pre-video, the mid-video, and the post-video.
I've only used it for probably, maybe a dozen, and I have not seen any ads anywhere, pre, mid, or post, on any of the videos that I watched. Now, whether the videos I watched had them in there in the first place, I don't know, but I have not seen any ads in the, I don't know, probably a dozen or two. Videos that I've watched.
And the original
How I learned about the Dash was going back to the, if I go back to the intelligence. So down at the bottom, theintelligence.com, cool tools. And they talk about it in there. And you can sign up to get their cool tools email sent to you. I think it's once a week. And it will include stuff like that. So great site to check out and great to get on their mailing list, because often they have stuff that's not really all that interesting to me, but there's usually at least every week or two, I have at least one nugget in all of that I find very useful. So highly recommend it.
I think this is really strange. Doesn't Google now own YouTube? So Google is moaning that you're using an ad blocker in YouTube and then giving you an option of not having ads through a Google website. It's kind of crazy.
Well, it's this thing where it's this YouTubeNoCookie.com, and so you're getting redirected by that. That is owned by Google, is owned by YouTube, and it is their privacy-enhanced embed feature. So my understanding is that that was intended for a very specific usage of YouTube. And people just found that, oh, by the way, it doesn't show any of the ads.
Love it.
Yeah, it's great. Anyhow, that's it.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. Okay, so I think the final thing we have already prepared is another item in my Vibe coding series. And if you recall, I last time I gave you this example of basically trying to clone PC Magazine's WMatch utility. And for those of you who haven't used WMatch, what you're looking at here is a two-panel view of two different folders. In this case, I'm actually looking at my drive D and my drive U, but essentially it's looking at the root folder. And then it's showing me all of the subfolders, and then the files, the individual files that are in the root folder. And you notice down the bottom that one of the DB files has a red X, which means that file is different on the backup folder on the right than it is in the original folder on the left. And then the ones with the blue check mark are exactly the same. So those files are exactly the same in both drives. And the final one there, the PY file, which is a Python script, only exists on the left. So the newest version of that file is in the left-hand folder. And what WMatch allows me to do is I can hit one of the icons and look at only the files that are different. I can check any ones that I wish to, and then I can either copy or move the files from one side to the other, from left to right, basically. So it's kind of a quick way of finding files which have been either new or updated, and then copying them to a backup drive. So if you remember, my example was, rather than try and describe to the chatbot how to do this, what I actually want, you know, build me a system that shows two folders on in a two-panel display. Rather than give it incredible levels of detail, I said, do you know about WMatch? And could you build it for me, basically? And we got this far. I got my two panels. I can tell it which folder I want on the left, and I can tell it which folder I want on the right. And it's giving me the file name, the size, in bytes, when it was modified. And then it's giving me a status, but in this case, it tells me the status on for every file on both sides of the ledger there. So in this case, none of those files exist on the left side. They all only exist on the right side. So that was kind of the story to date. So let's see what we can do to make things work a bit better. One of the things about chatbots is they're really helpful. Again, rather than having to tell it what I want, it knows I want to clone WMatch. So it's giving me a whole bunch of suggestions. And you know, what you want to do next is A, B, and C. So you need some arrows so you can copy files from left to right or right to left. And maybe you should have some color coding. So if the files were identical, they'd be green. And if they were different, they'd be red and so forth. And you definitely need to be able to sort the columns. So click on the header to sort them by file name or by modified date or whatever. And it's suggesting some text filters, file filters. I don't remember whether WMatch actually has file filters. I never actually use them. And then the other thing it wants is folder tree navigation. It says like the original program. So that would be nice. So it says, if you'd like, I can show you a much more advanced version. And it does all kinds of things. We'll do color highlighting and synchronized scrolling, that's what we really need. Synchronized scrolling for the two sides, and then the copy left and right buttons, and faster scanning. Well, at this point, I don't really care about faster scanning, but it's making the offer, so let's take it up and let it generate the code, and we'll run the new script. And so now we've got to this stage, and it kind of looks okay. We got some color there, green for identical, and blue for different, and blue's on one side only, I guess, and red is fire on both sides, but they're different. However, there's we've got all these things, but you know, we have to remember what these colors meant, because I don't remember what to do that. We've got a compare button, and we've got copy left and copy right buttons. And so we've got some of the stuff which it said we would have, but let's carry on and try and refine it. And now I think we're kind of where we should be giving it some instructions. So one of the things I don't want are these numbers down the side here. I don't really know what. It's an arbitrary file number. It's a numerical sequence, basically. It doesn't actually mean anything. It's not useful to me. So I said, drop the file number and the status columns and display only the first folder level. Because I want to get that situation where I can see subfolders in a given folder and then the files that are there as well. So it said, okay, we're going to remove the status column. We're only going to show folders in the selected folder, no recursion. It's going to retain the file size and modify. We've got two panels, and we're going to get the copy buttons. And it behaves more like the original WMatch browsing view, which is, you know, what I'm trying to get to. So here's what it gave me, the new script file when I run it. And sure enough, it's got rid of the status column, But you notice it's retained the numbers down the side here. And even worse, no, it's not this one, sorry. It's basically dropped the status column, which retained the numbers. So I'm still trying to get rid of these numbers, these dreaded 1, 2, 3 numbers. So now it's telling me, well, what you'd really like is to be able to navigate by rows in the file directory, which, if you remember, was something what we wanted. We wanted the subfolders and then the files, so that sounds like what we want. Enter a folder on double click, so I could select folder 1, for example, and just do a comparison of that one. And then have some indicators instead of a column, we're going to highlight rows, okay, maybe. And keyboard navigation, which I really don't want, but let's see what it says. Anyway, down here it says, I can show you a much nicer user interface layout that replicates the Norton Commander WMATS interface. And I think Chris is altering things here.
Oh, sorry. I probably hear the backspace. I'm typing into the chat.
Yeah, so it's going to give me the classic Norton Commander WMATS interface, which is much simpler to implement. Yeah, sure, let's implement it. So, let's sell it. Okay, give me the nicer layout that replicates WMATS interface. It's going to look something like this, and it's going to do all these wonderful things. And sure enough, when we tell it to do it, then we get this. So now we've got a double dot here to go backwards. We've got various folders, but if you notice that I'm looking at C:\ users toaster on the left and C:\ users toaster on the right, and I don't have the option to change those. And seems to be a slight problem in the new code. So I tell it, the version's lost the ability to select folders for left and right panes. Please add those back in. Oh, you're right. Of course I'm right. So let's do an improved version, and we'll do all this kind of stuff, and we have to save it as a PY file and run it, and here we are. So now I can tell it, go back to my data drive D and my backup drive U, and now I can see I've got all these different these different folders here. And if I have a little look here, I still got the file numbers. Yeah, I still got these stupid file numbers down the left hand side here. So I say, can you modify the code to drop the file numbers? So I'm now trying to give it a clue. And instead, display a yellow folder icon to the left of the directory listing. So it would be obvious to me that these are now subfolders in my listing. So it's going to remove the file number column, which is the size column, and it's going to display the yellow folder. No, I don't want you to remove the size column. That's not the number I'm talking about. I'm talking about the ordinal number of the file. So don't drop the size column. Don't display the ordinal numbers down the left side of each pane. Ah, I got it at last. You want to keep the size column and remove the file numbers. Yay! Amazing. All right, so let's see what it does this time. So now it's looking a lot more promising. I've got some subfolders here which are clear and obvious. Nice yellow folder label icons. I got a bunch of individual files in the root directory, and I've got a lot more files over on this side for some reason. Anyway, let's go and have a little look, and let's choose, we'll scroll down and choose the Alan subfolder here. We'll double click on him, and we'll find that we've got a WMATS clone folder. So let's double click on him, and now we can see that we've got a bunch of files on the backup and a bunch of files in the original, and you can see that there's one more file on the left hand side than on the right, but because they're not, it's still not synchronizing the listings here, so if you look carefully down the list here, you'll find that two panes are the same, and WMAX Advanced is the same, and Commander and V2 is the same. V3 is the one that's different, so I can highlight that one, and I could tell it to copy over here, copy this guy from the left side to the right side, and bingo. Now my two folder listings are exactly the same. So my program is doing some of the stuff that I want, but clearly we're not there yet. So we're making progress, but you notice how sometimes the chatbot just, I say, loses the plot. It just forgets about things that it did previously, and I don't know whether it thinks I didn't want them or whatever, but it goes off and does whatever it wants, and sometimes we have to kind of drag it back. However, I have obtained a two-pane window display. I can select a folder in each of those panes. It does now display the subfolders and the files the way I wanted it to. I've lost the... somebody's got background noise there.
Not anymore.
Thank you. And somewhere we lost those red, blue, and green colors. You notice there again, it was doing that. I didn't really want it that way, but they were there and now they're not. I didn't tell it to lose them. But I can select a folder and display the contents. But now I've lost that synchronization where the rows match up on both sides of both sides of the window. But I can actually select a file and the copy left and right buttons actually work. So we're getting a bit closer to the actual WMatch type thing. So here's what would happen if we'd been using WMatch on the same WMatch clone subfolder. You can see now it's obvious that because the files are synchronized in their listings, it actually, I think Richard's saying, is it left aligned? Size is left aligned. No, it's actually right aligned. They're listed alphabetically, but they're synchronized. So it's clear that the new version over here is the one that's missing on the right-hand side, and it's got the left arrow telling me
the size was left aligned in the previous slide that you had.
Ah, okay. Sorry, I didn't pick up on that. Yes, you're right. It is. All right. Well, again, I didn't ask it to do either, so I guess I'd have to fix that one too. Anyway, this is the actual WMatch program, and I could select that and then go up here and copy it. It also has some other neat things, like this button right here will actually compare this is comparing them by time date stamp. But if I use this guy, it will compare it doing a bit-for-bit content comparison. So then this is where the colors come from. The green means that these files are identical. The blue means that this file is new and that file is newer than this file over here, which actually doesn't exist. So clearly it's new. And so these are the kind of differences. I'm not actually getting a true version of WMatch, but I'm getting closer. But you notice that you have to keep giving it new prompts to make it do things the way you want. And sometimes it loses track of what it's doing, so you have to kind of try and bring it back to normality. Okay, so that's all I have on WMatch for now. I see later on whether I've got some more to talk to you about. But in the meantime...
It's interesting, before we leave the whole idea of using vibe coding, I just started playing around with it a little bit today, and I find it astounding the number of times that it will come back and I'll say, well, it didn't do this right. And it's like, oh, you're exactly right. And here is the perfect solution. And I'll try that, and it screws up either the same way or a different way, and it'll come back and say, oh, that's because the syntax is wrong here. This is what you really want to have happen. And I think I'm up to version 14 of the script or something like that, and it's still screwing up. So I'm currently working with ChatGPT. I think I'm going to give up on it for a while. It's really, really close to what I wanted it to do, fairly simple operation that I added. I think I'm going to move on to something else. I started off with Perplexity, and it did a worse job. and ChatGPT did a pretty good job, but there's a couple of things it seems to be really stuck on and it just can't fix. And so I think I'm going to move on, and the next one I'm going to try is probably Microsoft Copilot on Alan's recommendation that I give it a shot. So it's fun to play with, but it can be a struggle, as Alan has alluded to.
And then it also gets to the point where it repeats the same stuff that didn't work before.
Yeah.
Patience is a virtue with this stuff, but if you have a small project, it can actually do a really bang-up job. But some things, it goes really wild.
Yeah, and Harvey suggests that I try Google Gemini, and sure, I'll give that a try too. I find it actually quite fascinating and a big time waster.
Or Grok is another one to try.
Yeah, I have a tendency to really avoid anything that has anything to do with Elon Musk, just on principle. But maybe I'll give it a shot too.
Apparently, Claude has a very good reputation for code generation.
Yeah, I think if you're willing to pay for it under Grok, but my understanding is Grok could you only get good stuff if you're willing to pay for it. But I may be wrong on that.
Is Claude under Grok?
What's that?
Claude, I meant. C-L-A-U-D.
Oh, Claude.
Oh, Claude. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Claude. Yeah, Claude is another one that I think does really good stuff if you're willing to pay for it.
Yeah, if you're interested in vibe coding, I highly recommend you give it a try, because I suspect that they're all going to go paid versions eventually.
That's true.
They seem to be moving that way.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to all the computer programmers?
They're getting out of business real quick. I think it was Perplexity. They say that their internal programming is 100% done by AI now. And I've heard other stats that say that worldwide coding is about 70% done by AI now. And it's only increasing.
I guess that's the end of that university degree.
Yes, I don't know. And I just read an article today that somebody, I can't remember what is with, maybe OpenAI, and they were saying that they figured we're only about 2 years away from AI generating its own next version. So it's no longer going to be humans even programming the AI models.
Okay, anybody else have any other questions before we close up shop here? Questions or comments?
I think I've been following the chat pretty well, and I don't think there's any comments in there.
Another question for Alan. When are you going to move on to compare 3+ directories?
When am I going to move on to what, sorry?
To compare 3+ directories at the same time.
I'm not. Sounds like three-dimensional chess. I have no interest in that. Okay, let's move along then with the wrap-up. Last week, David Swain offered to do 3D printing, and he's got a deck ready for us. So we can't do it next week because that's our monthly meeting, but it looks like he's going to be doing it on May the 20th. So if you're interested in 3D printing, you don't know anything about it, this is the ground-up version of how-to. Coming up at the library, Chris and Linda are going to be busy. Chris is going to be talking about protecting your PC for all those people who had questions in the survey. At Metcalf on Thursday, May the 7th. That's tomorrow, I guess, at 2 p.m. And Linda is busy that day, too, in the evening at 6 o'clock at Centennial, talking about macro close-up photography. And then on Monday at Carlingwood, again at 6 p.m., how to buy a digital camera. Chris will give you the scoop. And as usual, if you want to register for any of those options or the other programs that Chris and Linda are giving at the library, then you need to use that link there and register through the library to be able to attend the session. Okay, coming up in June, we have our pizza queue, and we'd like to hear from you if you're planning on attending. We need to know how many people are coming and what kind of pizza they would like so that we don't spend a fortune on food that we don't use. So please send an email to pizzaparty2026@opcug.ca, and details are on the website. Next week is our monthly meeting, May the 13th, and this is going to be a special one. It's Stump the Geeks. No, it's Ask the Geeks. Your computer, Chris doesn't want to be stumped, I guess. So ask any questions. We've got a panel of people here bursting with computer knowledge. It's quite amazing. I ask them what their backgrounds are, so I'll tell you all about that next week. But between us, we should be able to answer most questions. If you have any questions about computer-related things, next week is your chance.
Alan, was that Stump the Geeks or Stomp the Geeks?
Stump, yeah. So if you have questions, think about your questions, because you'll certainly be able to ask them at the meeting. If you want to send them to me ahead of time, then just send them to this email address, and I will add them to the list. Now, because it's a monthly meeting next week, we will not have a Q&A. The whole thing is going to be a Q&A. But our next official Q&A is going to be in 2 weeks on May the 20th. So if you have questions for Q&A or topics that you'd like to share, like 3D printing, or answers to the questions that we've asked tonight that needed flushing out maybe, or you can always contact us through suggestion box, and we'll be happy to deal with your input. So, lots of stuff tonight. I hope everybody enjoyed the presentations, and think up your questions for next week. Ask the Geeks. We'll see you then.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.